Hello, world. It's Mike Traverso at the Friends That Code podcast, where I get a chance to showcase some amazing people that I know that just happen to write code for a living. Folks, today I have the pleasure of speaking with someone that many of you already know from the Thunder Nerds podcast, a podcast that talks to, quote, the people behind the technology that do tech good, end quote. In addition to being the newest member of the Thunder Nerds, today's guest is no stranger to a microphone. With her expertise in design, she's an incredibly sought-after speaker. She's taken that expertise across the country and around the world, giving talks on design and sharing her knowledge, helping others become better designers. Having used her talents to design wonderful user experiences across various startups here in the Tampa Bay area, she's also worked and used her talents at GitLab, Envision, and now at Honeycomb, where she's making it easier for you to operate your DevOps solutions more easily. Today's guest is also a community builder. She's been a founding member of Tampa's Women Who Code, was a chapter leader of Girl Develop It, and a member of Envision's Design Leadership Forum. Building community is important to today's guest, but so is making sure that her local tech design community is also accessible, welcoming, and proactively reaching out to women. You may not know that today's guest also really enjoys board games, so much so that she's created a space here in the Tampa area that you can come and play them. I'm talking, of course, about Your Turn Cafe, which is located up in Zephyr Hills, and lets folks come together and play board games in a welcoming space, enjoy some delicious coffees, some wine, and some light food, and it's a great way to spend an afternoon or a weekend with some family or some friends. She's also incredibly kind, folks, because I thought we were recording this at 4 p.m. instead of at 3 p.m., and she was so nice to even come back and agree to meet with me today. She's incredible. Designer, manager, community organizer, conference speaker, mentor, author, board game cafe proprietor. Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest is Sarah Veselov. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Good. That was a lot. Oh my goodness. And I will warn everyone, I'm in my cafe right now. That's where I work. So you may hear a ding in the background. I'm using my special headphones. So hopefully there won't be distracting background noise, but sometimes you can hear some people in the background.
Awesome. So from like, you know, we've been talking about local, right? And you know, you've got this amazing business up in Zephyr Hills. And we mentioned it at the end of the intro. Late last year, you and your husband started, or I guess late 2019, you and your husband started your Turn Cafe. By the way, I love the name of it. And it's a cafe that focuses on letting patrons get their board game and get going, right? Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So this was an idea that started a long time ago. My husband is a collector of board games, and the collection got a little out of control to the point where we had so many and we couldn't play them all. And I don't know, I'm one of those people, if I have something that I'm not using, I try to find someone else that can use it. So for me, you know, it was really important that they don't just sit on a shelf and they get played. So it kind of was bugging him. And then we ran out of room. And at the point, we get to the point where it was like an episode of Hoarders, but for board games. In 2019, we decided, let's do this. I had left GitLab. I was kind of like doing some soul searching in my career. My husband was kind of burnt out. He's a nurse and he was kind of I'm ready for something else. And so that's where it started. And we actually didn't open until March of this year. As you can hear, probably there's people in the background. They just, of course, just walked in now. but we started in March during COVID. We were supposed to open in September. We did a whole bunch of renovations and there was just, you know, whatever timing you think you need, add like 6 months to that, like that always. So
a developer, I do that always. Add 6 months.
Same. It's the same everywhere, except this time, you know, it wasn't bugs or anything. It was contractors. That was the problem. Like, you know, that's a whole nother set of bugs right there. but it's interesting to me how many people in this industry love board games. And so we have a really good group of people that come in that aren't just board game fanatics, but are our designers and developers and people in the tech industry.
Awesome. Awesome. Is there something, because I know this has got to be an incredibly tough time for you to be running a in-person business, especially something with board games. Is there something that your fans or fans of board games in general can help do to support the cafe, keep it going?
Honestly, just sharing it, following us on Facebook. I know money is tight for everybody right now and things are uncertain, and I would never ask anyone to give what they can't give, but really just a thumbs up and a like and a share and interaction on our posts is super, super helpful. It helps keep us on the feed. It helps keep us alive. And, you know, we'll be here after this stuff starts to settle down, and then they can come buy some stuff. That's when I'll ask them to come actually hang out and buy some stuff. But right now, just liking and sharing is great.
All right. That's easy enough to do. So folks, let's do that. People would be angry if I didn't ask, what is your favorite board game?
So, it's funny. A lot of people ask that. Our favorite board game does not live in the cafe. It's called Camp Grizzly. And it's a family game we all have played for a long time. It was a Kickstarter, and it's basically like this campy take on 1970s, 1980s horror movies. Okay. So it's collaborative. You are camp counselors and you're up against this killer named Otis. He has like a teddy bear mask and a knife. And so you're running around like getting saddled with campers, and you're trying to find all these pieces so that you can make your escape. It was a small run. It's really hard to get. We have all the expansions. We have everything. What we have is worth over $1,500. So we do not have it in the cafe. Yeah. I mean, it's like a $50 board game that has just slowly risen in cost. But it's interesting. Before it became so, you know, sought after, we used to play it as a family. And my son's 19th birthday was just last week, and he came in with his friends and they all wanted to play Camp Grizzly because they remember doing it at Halloween parties. And I'm like, oh, hell no, you're not touching that game. No.
Yeah. Not today.
No, not today.
That's cool. Well, happy birthday to your son.
Oh, thanks.
You know, so I mentioned also too, you've been a lot, you know, you've been a fixture in the Tampa community, which I don't think is any understatement at all. You've done a lot of work with different startups in the community. You've worked at GitLab, and you've worked at Honeycomb, and you've worked on some big time projects as a designer. You've also written a book as well, Building Design Systems Unify User Experiences Through a Shared Design Language. And first off, as a developer, I can't say enough of how awesome it is to work with a designer that uses a shared design language. So thank you so much. It makes things so much easier for a development perspective. But what is a design, for folks who don't know, what is a design system or shared design language?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think when a lot of people hear design system, they think components. So they're thinking of just either the React components, or they're thinking of even just thinking of their Figma library with the little parts and pieces that they pull together. But a design system is everything together. Your components are part of that system. Your design language is part of that system. Your do's and don'ts, your guidelines, your branding, even extending into your marketing. And I see a design system as kind of like it's your guidebook for how you make decisions, from everything from the visual branding to the, you know, the user experience decisions, what pieces you use. And that even goes down into the front end implementation decisions that you make in terms of what is a reusable component, where do they live, how do they, what are the variants based on where they actually are shown to the user. And it's interesting because I've had a lot of conversations with people where I say design language and they're like, oh, that sounds like one of those fruity design terms. Like, ooh, it's a language. But it really is. And it's so basic to me. And probably because I've just been doing it so long, it feels like so fundamental. But if you think about it, you know, we use color and spacing and iconography and the pieces and parts of things to tell a story, to bring the user through the page, to explain things, and to let the user know what it is that they can and can't do. And that's what a language does, right? It gives you that feedback that you need to understand what you can do with this thing. And so really, we're trying to make sure that we're telling the right story. That is, so a language, a design language for a company is related to that particular company, right? Your culture, who you are, who you want to be, who you want to project, what your goal is for your users. So you want to make sure, you know, you can't just take it and oh, this design language works great for Atlassian. We're going to take it and put it over here on GitLab. Two totally different companies. There may be overlap in some of their offerings, but the culture is different. The end user is different. And so you have to reflect that in the way that you actually present to the user. So I think that's kind of like the easiest basic way to say that it really is just it's taking those pieces and telling stories with it in the UI.
Yeah. No, I love it. I working with a designer who understands the implementing a design language for an app or a series of apps, it's so comforting because you know that everything's kind of been thought out. It's that when you're getting to certain interactions that you have to do it the same way over and over again. In other words, you don't have giant orange buttons here and little red buttons there. You know, for that do the same thing. So it's just nice. It's for a developer, it's like a warm blanket. So if you're a developer and you're working with a designer, ask for a design language if you can. It's a great thing to work with.
Yeah.
And speaking of which, I read you were at GitLab and you're working on a redesign, GitLab 10, and you wrote this, I guess, a white paper on what you guys were doing to get to that 10.0 release. And I thought it was fascinating because, one, I've never seen anything like that before, where someone has kind of gone back and looked and seen, hey, how things have gone, and then published it. And one of the things that you mentioned in that white paper is you go into some of the first iterations of that new design and you mention how it's failed. So that's something also I've never seen before, where someone publicly announces to the world, this didn't work. And, you know, most of the time people are only publishing how fantastic they are. And that's it. You kind of conclude basically that it's important to know what your customers are doing and not necessarily what they are saying that they're doing. Can you expound on that? Like, what did you mean by that?
So often we don't know what we're doing. I mean, I can say the same for me. When especially as a user experience designer, when talking with people, when you just have a conversation, right? You're asking them questions, often open-ended. They'll tell you a lot of the things that they want, a lot of the things that they believe will make their life easier. Oh, if I just had a button here. Oh, if I could see everything all at once. And they'll tell you a lot of things. The problem is that's an off-the-cuff, gut reaction kind of want. They don't often know what they really need. When you're actually using an application and you're maneuvering around it, it's a much different experience. I kind of liken it to if you have this experience where you're standing over someone's shoulder and they have their hands on the keyboard and they're going for things. You can always like see what they're looking for before they see it. And you're like, it's over there. And they're like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's kind of the same thing. You know, it's easy to say what you think you need. It's much different when your hands are on that keyboard and you're moving around and you're looking for those things. So it's really important to listen to what they say that they want and need, because you're going to have to address that. You can't just say, no, you don't know what you're saying. Here's this other thing. You're going to have to address and work with them on why they think they need that, and then explaining to them why they actually need this other thing. But watching what they do, you very quickly will see where they're running into a wall, where they're going in circles, where they're getting confused. And I do that myself when I go into an application for the first time, if I'm working on it and I have something to do with the design. Otherwise, I just complain like everyone else, like, this sucks, this is the worst thing ever. But when I'm the one designing it, I'm always, even if it's like 2 seconds of confusion of like, where is this thing? I make a note of it, because that's something you'll very quickly forget, right? You'll find it, you'll move on. But as a new user, that's that 2 seconds of friction, 3 seconds of friction. You start adding that up and all of a sudden it felt like a really janky experience. And so you want to make sure that you're keeping note of that. I feel like I'm going on a tangent, but anyway.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
And let me tell you why, because when I was a younger developer, I wish I knew to do this, because what I would do is I'd sit down with a user or a new customer and I'd say, hey, how can I help you? And undoubtedly, it's exactly like you said, they want this and they want that. And if they just had this button and they just had this spreadsheet, or they had another row or whatever, life would be so much easier for them. And then you work and you work and you work and you give that to them. And they're like, this isn't what I wanted. This doesn't help me. This is just extra. And it's like, oh, okay, now it's time to go back to the drawing board. But that is fantastic advice that you give, which is watch what they're doing, get into their flow and understand like, where can you improve that? So from a designer's perspective, and then from if you're just a developer who thinks that you're running a startup by yourself, where you've got to have a bunch of hats, that's also good advice there too as well.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think another thing that, you know, talking about design systems and talking to users and kind of all of this stuff, you know, I started the way a lot of people did is it was building things in HTML and CSS. And I was a web designer, I was a web developer, and then I was a front-end engineer. And then when JavaScript took over the world, all of a sudden I was a designer, right? It's like, oh, well, you know, I didn't want to continue going further down the stack. I was much more interested in making that experience the best it could be and thinking about those problems, not worrying so much about back-end problems per se. And so, but a large part of my career was spent taking designs that either I had designed or someone else had and implementing that in HTML and CSS and doing it on both a small scale and a large scale. So I had to be very aware of, one, making sure we're building the right thing, right? Because you go and you build it and then it's like, oh, that isn't what I asked for. And you're like, oh, great. Let me just redo 6 months worth of work. But also, you know, making sure that it's scalable and maintainable from both a design and a developer perspective. I mean, I think I've kind of found for me that sweet spot of where like all of this experience, I can use it in the form of a design system and in talking about design systems and managing teams of designers who are building these, because this is really that place where design and development meet. And it's where we can have that conversation and make that so much easier and really iterate a lot faster. You know, if we make these components that are smaller and more easy to kind of move around and make adjustments and it goes across the whole system, then, you know, you can take more chances and you can make more changes and see where it goes and then very quickly adjust. So I think it's that background that really feeds that interest and that focus for me as a designer.
Again, coming back to design language and why it's such a great thing to have.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just jankiness. Like you're trying to design with jankiness.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But it also empowers, I think, a design language, a design system, but definitely a design language empowers the rest of the team. And that's the conversation I've been trying to have having with the engineers that I work with now at Honeycomb is that I don't want to be a blocker. I don't want people to feel like, oh, I need to add this thing, but I got to wait for design and I know they're busy. And, you know, we're all busy, but if we have defined a language and we've designed we have some guidelines out there and there's some components, you should be able to get about 95% of the way there without us. Not saying that we're no longer useful, but we also don't want to hold up on things that are obvious. They're better than we have today and they're going to make a difference for users. I want people to, everybody across the org to feel empowered to make that decision, move forward, and then we'll just make it better from there.
Awesome. Awesome. So yeah, for folks who are out there listening or managers who are out there listening, get your design language going, because like Sarah's saying, there's an investment, but you do empower the team. You're getting your money's worth from your designer. You're empowering your team. You're getting a better way to move forward with changes. It's just so fantastic. Again, can't say enough about good design language. Speaking of conversations though, Sarah, you have spoken all around the world, numerous times here in the Tampa Bay, St. Pete area, across the country. For example, in Iceland, in Taiwan, the Czech Republic. But before any of that happens, you have to start somewhere, right? Tell me about your earliest speaking engagement that you can remember and how did it start for you?
I can remember too. And it wasn't that long ago. I've been kind of under the radar for a long time, just doing my thing, doing my art, doing my development doing what I do. And in 2015, I believe it was, I got my first speaking engagement for WordCamp Miami, I think. Okay. I think that's what it was. And it was on accessibility. Again, because I started as a front-end engineer. I mean, that's what I did for years and years and years, along with design. And so I did a talk on accessibility and why it's important, and why it's important to think of it as like table stakes, like part of your everyday thinking as you design and as you develop, and not leave it for the end as like this big project, because it'll never get done. And so that was my first speaking engagement. I can remember being so nervous about it and so excited. And it just kept going from there. I've always been a teacher. So I taught for a few colleges. I taught HTML, CSS, JavaScript, design portfolio classes. I can write a resume like no one's business. So, you know, I did a lot of that. And I think that's the aspect of speaking that I like, that it feels like, hey, I did this thing and I totally messed it up. I'm going to tell you what I messed up so that you don't do that. You know, and the same thing with being a manager. I mean, to me, being a manager is being a teacher. It's not about, I don't tell people what to do or, you know, oversee or micromanage. I'm like, you know, how can I make it so that you enjoy coming to work every day? How can I give you a situation and a system where you feel like you are growing and you're challenged and you're empowered every day? Even if that means it's not here, it's going somewhere else. And I mean, that's just part of the thing, you know, that you do. So yeah, that's where it started. But it probably started with teaching for me. I think getting up in front of people and teaching was like the baby step before the actual.
Yeah, I started out a similar path, like as a teaching assistant in college. So mm-hmm. watching that spark of someone getting something.
Yeah.
You get that high, you know, and then you just kind of like a junkie, you just kind of need it.
Yeah. It's so selfish, isn't it? Like people are always like, oh, you're so giving. I'm like, no, this is totally selfish. Like,
oh no, I take the praise. Yeah. I'm okay. I guess I'm a little giving. Sure. But you know, so going back, it must've been really cool to kind of be talking about accessibility before it was kind of cool to be talking about accessibility. Right. Well, cause now everybody's talking about accessibility and you know, so anyway, so I just wanted to point that out to folks. It shouldn't be an afterthought. It should be in the foreground, because you wouldn't, you know, you design, you know, for folks, you're designing your apps out there for folks with sight, right? That's not an afterthought, right? You didn't accidentally think we should put the button here, or we should make this interface this way. So, okay. What's been your favorite experience public speaking to date?
Oh my goodness. My favorite experience.
And why?
Wow. I got to think about this for a second.
A lot of people would think like, oh, flying you across the world, you know, going to Taiwan or going to the Czech Republic might be one of them. But honestly, I think that kind of seems like so much more pressure, right? Because you've got to not just give the talk, but you've got to travel.
You know, I love to travel. I'm again, selfish. I'm like, ooh, how far away is this talk? Like, it's in Tampa? I don't know. You know, I really love travel. I mean, those were stressful talks. I think the one I enjoyed the most was actually this one sticks out in my mind. I gave a talk the first time I gave this talk, how to style and react and not lose friends, was in Atlanta for Women Who Code, a conference there. And it was this group of just badass ladies, and we were laughing and talking. And then after, I sat down with a few people and we started, you know, actually coding and working through some stuff in React. And for me, that was like, that's why I'm there. That's what I want to do. I want to connect with people and have that conversation. And like even in, so I spoke in Beijing, and that was extremely stressful, especially because the caliber of speakers there. I mean, I was like, I don't know, Jack Tripper up there, if anybody here is old enough to remember Three's Company, but that was me. And, you know, they're all, you know, and I go up and I'm just like, and I've got my yellow hair and my chucks on. And I was just like, this is crazy. But there was one guy in the audience who just kept smiling and nodding. And he was so excited that I was there and that I was talking GitLab. And like, it took, like, I just focused on that person. I was like, even if it sucks for everybody else, I'm sorry, but this guy totally gets it.
That's great advice though. That's fantastic advice for folks who are out there giving a talk, and that if you're giving a talk to a room and you see, you know, there's a few people in the room that are getting it, focus on them.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Don't try to convince the rest of the room why your talk is awesome. If they're not smiling or laughing or at your corny jokes on your slides, just focus on them, which is hard nowadays with Zoom because you've got to find them in the gallery view, but you know, if you can find them, that's great.
Yeah.
But why is it important for you though, to have women in tech or women in design to get up and speak at the local meetups?
Oh boy. It's
a bit of a loaded question, but
it is. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I just wanted to say, because I want to make sure that folks know, like, it's not journalism here. It's just us hanging out. But I want to know, because you've been such a big part of building up, you know, local tech groups for women here in the Tampa Bay area, you know, and not only that, but folks, for you to understand where Sarah is coming from to travel down to produce some of these meetups, it's not a quick drive. It's a trek.
Yeah.
What is it that makes it important though, for you to go ahead, make that trek, put these meetups together, put these just groups together, and then have women get up and give talks?
You know, again, I think it's probably really selfish. Like, if I look back, you know, and I can sit here and talk about women, we're underrepresented and we're underpaid, and like, everybody knows all of that. I don't think I have to say any of that. And if you don't believe it, I'm not going to change your mind in a 5-minute diatribe about it. But what I will say is that growing up, I'm 43. So I grew up, I was a latchkey kid. Like, I grew up at the time when like the Breakfast Club, like there were the losers, there were the popular group, there were the nerds. And like, I was one of the losers and I just didn't fit in. And I didn't have, you know, that clique, that group. I had an interest in art. I had an interest in brainier things, I guess. You know, I didn't care about banana clips and you know, my three-layered pairs of socks or anything. I mean, I was really into other things, but there wasn't a place for me. There was no encouragement. There were no role models. There was no one out there who was, you know, I didn't see women playing D&D. I didn't see women. I remember it was a scandal when I got a BMX bike. My dad was so mad that I wanted a BMX bike, so he made sure to get me a black and purple one because that was appropriate for a girl. I mean, that's what I grew up in. And so I think
the 80s.
So I think for me, I just see it as like, I want to do that for somebody else. Like, you know, there weren't really those role models for me. There weren't those people that I could look to and say, hey, look, if they can do it, I mean, because it really does make a big difference. You know, we're very social creatures and it's hard to step out of yourself sometimes and take that risk if you don't see other people doing it. But if you see some crazy lady up there with yellow hair, swearing her head off, wearing her chucks, saying like, you can do this. If I can do this, you can. Maybe you're going to take a risk, you know, maybe you're going to say, oh, maybe I can. And honestly, that's what matters most to me is just, you know, and it's not just women. It's anyone that feels like an outsider, that feels like an outcast. I have lots of men that I talk to that are like, oh, you know, I really, you know, I appreciate the way that you said this or the way that you stated this or the fact that you shared like how you messed all this stuff up and like, you know, owning that. Because, you know, for a very long time, I think the messaging that at least I got was you have to be perfect. You have to be better than everybody else. You can't make mistakes. You know, and you gotta stick up for yourself and unless you're a woman and then you gotta be quiet. So I stopped being quiet a long time ago. I was like, yeah, whatever.
It's a good strategy. I mean, well, not strategy, but it's a good philosophy to have because, you know, being sitting in the back and kind of, you know, not getting up there or listening to someone kind of tell you why you're wrong, you know, that stuff's not healthy. People can believe whatever they want. As long as you're enjoying it, do it. And as long as it's not hurting anybody either.
Yeah.
And getting up and talking in front of a crowd of folks, it is, you will feel a little nervous, but I think a lot of that is mostly excitement. And, you know, give it a try, because if you like it, great. If you don't like it, you know, it's not a big deal. Because, you know, people make a bigger deal out of what other people think, whereas what's happening is other people are worrying about what you're thinking of them. Mm-hmm. And so just get up there and do it. Whatever kind of gets you up there, just get up there and do it. And you've done a lot in the, especially for women in the Tampa Bay community, to get them up and doing it. So, you know, Women Who Code, Girl Develop It. I mean, there's a lot. And, you know, on top of that, I think what's really cool is that you're also on the Thunder Nerds as a co-host. So that's kind of cool. So real quick, what is the Thunder Nerds podcast?
So the Thunder Nerds is a couple of dorks that needed help. So I swooped in to save their asses. No, I'm kidding. So Fred and Brian, I've known them for a little while. When I say a little while, gosh, I think I've probably known them about at least 4 years now. Time means nothing anymore after 2020. It's such a hard thing to like even know what planet I'm on, but knew them in the scene, like met them at meetups, saw both of them speak. They asked me to be on their podcast a while ago. And I really enjoyed it. It was so much fun. And then at one point, I think I even crashed a podcast that they were doing at the, the one in St. Pete, the conference down there.
The UX conference.
The front end design conference.
There you go.
Yeah. So they were like somewhere and I came like it was a friend of mine. Like we planned it ahead of time. I like came hopping in and was like, have you read my book? You know, like.
That's so cool.
And so after that, they asked if I'd be interested. And I definitely was. You know, I love meeting people and talking to people. And I feel like I'm probably like the quietest one on that podcast, though. Like,
next to Frederick. I mean.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I know.
I love the show. I do. I love the show. But yeah, I.
He's good with the questions. Like he's really good at like setting
he's a good and he's a great entertainer.
He is. Yes. But I'm more like the, I'm not going to prepare. I'll just figure it out when I get there kind of person. Like that's just me. And okay. So, you know, I'm much more like in the moment conversational, like on the fly. That's why like today I was like, oh, we'll do it at 4. Like, I don't care. I'm like, you know, I'm not worried about it. Like you get what you get. But you know, so sometimes I think it's hard for me to like know when to jump in because he seems like he's on a roll and he's just got it. And I think of like a quick barb and I'm like, maybe I'll just hold on to that, you know?
It is a great show. I recommend everybody to get out there on their, favorite podcast platform and subscribe to Thunder Nerds. You guys also live stream your sessions whenever they tend to be, because I know sometimes the schedule changes depending on guests. So, but you guys are also on YouTube. So I strongly encourage everybody to subscribe on their Twitter account at Thunder Nerds. And, you know, you guys have built a community of folks behind that, which is fantastic. If you have someone in mind that you could interview for the show, who would it be?
Oh, gosh, that I haven't interviewed? Because, I mean, we've interviewed some. I mean, Frederick.
Or who would you interview again? If you got another get, like who would you interview again?
Oh, gosh. Oh, my Lord. You ask the craziest questions. You know what? I know who I would interview that I don't think we've ever interviewed. And I know I can get this person. So you have sparked an idea.
So an easy get.
Aisha Blake. Do you know who that is?
I don't. No.
All right. Hold on. I'm looking up her Twitter right now. So Aisha and I met through Michelle Sinowitz, which I'm probably butchering her name. I'm sorry, Michelle.
No, Sinowitz is, I think, correct.
Okay. I'm right. So Aisha Blake, she now works for my arch enemy. She's working for New Relic. Oh, tried to get her at Honeycomb and it just didn't happen. But she and I are actually on the down low working on an app together that is related to board games.
Very cool.
Yeah. But she is so talented and so amazing. And I love, and she's so much fun. She does her, so I'm like all over the place with this. I met her through Michelle Sinowitz because Aisha is interested in opening up a board game cafe in Detroit. And so we connected, and for anybody listening that's interested in opening their own business or a cafe, like, I am perfectly willing to jump on a call and talk about all the mistakes that I made to help you and save you money. So that's what we did. We jumped on and just talked about, you know, the challenges and the ways that we've approached it. And we jumped on and we did a Zoom game with them. We actually played a game through Zoom. Cool. They had the camera set up and they are hilarious. And she would be a fantastic guest. So I think I know what I'm going to have to do now.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that episode.
Yeah, me too. And I'm going to tell Frederick that I'm asking all the questions. He can't ask.
You know what? That would be kind of fun to see someone else open the show, just put everybody else off guard. You know, that would be crazy. That would be such a crazy episode. I say do it.
Just once. My God. I'm glad he does it because I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm always like, wait, what? Like,
Well, there you go. That'll keep you kind of like, you know, in it, you know?
I get so nervous. It's so funny. Like, I am a super anxious person. I get really nervous.
Look, I have a set of notes that I write up. I think I sent you a bunch of questions last week or something like that, or a couple of weeks ago. I think I sent you like what we would have talked about. It's just, for me, it's easier to kind of keep my mind on track because otherwise it'll just tangent all over the place. And then I'm not sure I would get the right show. And especially since I'm asking of your time, and I'm getting it for free. Actually, you know, like I tell people all the time, the podcast is really just for me to scam my way into talking to a bunch of cool people constantly.
So hey, whatever you got to do.
But so speaking of cool people as well, you know, we were talking again about community. You built community from the ground up. You've done it with the Women Who Code here in Tampa. You've been a chapter leader at Girl Develop It. You've been on Envision's Design Leadership Forum. You know, obviously it's important for you to help women in tech and in design. We talked about that. But when you speak or you attend the meetups that you attend, what is it that you hope folks can come away with? Even if it's not important, like even if it's not relevant to the topic at hand, what's the one thing that you were always hoping that someone who's attending your meetups or your events walked away with?
I think for me, a sense of welcome and camaraderie to me is the most important thing. I think, my therapist would have a great time talking to me about this if I had one. because I feel, and this is part of my cafe too, I like giving people a space where they feel like they can just be themselves and they belong and they had a good time. Even when I interview people, for jobs, it's more of a conversation. I'm interested in who you are as a person and learning kind of a little bit about you and connecting in some way and getting that little bit of like human connection. I guess it's maybe the extrovert in me that really like, I get something out of that connection. It's like this spark of like energy. But I enjoy that, you know, I'll meet a lot of people that have been to my talks and, often the things that they remember is I cracked a joke about something that they thought was funny, or they remember me being, you know, welcoming or whatever. And that's great. Like to me, that's just as good as remembering some amazing tip that you heard.
Excellent. And I love that. What you said about hiring. I love the fact that you just have a conversation instead of, here's 10 questions. Oh, you don't know them, get the hell out of here. I love those conversations. Cause it's like, you can get on someone's GitHub account or you can see what they've done in the past. But can you tolerate this person? That's the thing.
Yeah. Can you have a productive conversation with this person? And you're not going to find out if you're both wearing this mask of I'm the interviewer, you're the interviewee, I'm going to make you really uncomfortable. I just don't get a lot out of that. I also would say, like, for anybody out there who has to do interviewing, it is amazing what people will tell you when they feel comfortable. It is an easy way to weed people out. Like, easy.
Yeah. All right. So we all know, Sarah, you're incredibly selfish when it comes to these meetups, right? What has been the most, what's been the most rewarding experience for you out of everything that you've done in the community or speaking, talking, whatever? What's been your most rewarding experience?
Like, there's so many.
Well, what's that type? What, like, if you had, like, if you, cause you can, I imagine you can, you have that type of experience that most of these fall under. What's that? What is that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's that, and I've had this experience, I actually had this experience at the cafe this past week, and it's what I was missing from meetups. And it's what I sometimes miss when I'm not in an interviewing phase and I'm not getting to meet new people. So we had opened up the cafe. It was Friday or Saturday. I can't remember. It doesn't really matter. But a couple came in and they grabbed some coffees and chatted and they sat down up front. And now they sat down up here. Now behind me is a bunch of books. We have like a whole bunch of free stuff that people can read, coloring books. It's also where I keep all my design books, like on the very top shelf, because I work here all day long. And so I need to be able to jump up and grab a book and do my thing. Right. So the couple came over and they sat down and I looked down, and now it's not there right now, but I had my book up there. Because I thought it was hilarious. I'm like, ooh, let me put my own book up here, because nobody knows my name. No one's going to know it's my book. So I getting the tea ready. I'm ready to bring it down. And I see that he's sitting there reading my book. And it was like, nice. So I come walking down and put the tea down. And the woman says, is there someone here who's really into design? Because like, these are really specific books, like, really specific. And she had my meeting design book in her hand, written by someone else, not one I wrote. Okay. And I was like, yeah, actually, I'm a design manager. I work for, you know, a San Francisco tech company, but, you know, I work remote. And I said, I work here all day. Those are my books. And she's like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, actually, that book you have right there, I wrote that. And they were so excited. And we spent the next 20 minutes talking shop. We talked about like the case study that I wrote, the one that you had talked about earlier. And I talked about what I was working on at Honeycomb. I'm actually building a design system all over again. I've actually found myself pulling my own book on the shelf and be like, wait a minute. What did I say about this? I mean, it's true. You just do. And you could tell, like, it was one of those things where it was really exciting for me because somebody was excited about my work and I got to share and talk. And it was exciting for them. They're like, holy crap, I came to this cafe to have a coffee and, you know, meet the author of this book, like in Zephyr Hills, Florida. What the heck? Cool. Yeah. So it was really, really nice. And he actually bought it. It was my last author's copy that I had from the publisher, and he asked if he could buy it. And I told my husband, I'm like, look at how much it is on Amazon. And I'll just charge him that.
As a matter of fact, I like collecting books authored by folks in the tech community here in Tampa. So yeah. I have Craig Clayton's book. I have Joey DeVia's book. I will soon have a copy of your book. I ordered it a couple of days ago.
Oh, so nice.
Waiting for that to come in. And once COVID's over, I'm going to have Joey and Craig and hopefully you sign the books and then just kind of keep them on one shelf.
We should do a thing here. I'll make you all come up to Zephyr Hills. What I want to do is start having tech events here and meetups here at the cafe. Yeah.
And, you know, I would sponsor that and you do a showcase of authors.
That would be awesome. I'll
get a bunch of books, and then the first so ever many folks that come in get to pick which author they want, and they get their book autographed.
And we can all sit there and fight and hawking our books. Whoever can scream the loudest.
Bribing people in the line. Like, yeah.
Yeah. But that's honestly part of what I want to do up here. So I started a nonprofit this year, well, last year, but it's really starting this year in this area called the Zephyr Hills Arts Alliance. Like I don't have enough things to do, but
yeah, I was going to say that's a lot.
Yeah, I know.
But that's great. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, again, I have this space that I can use. I wanted it to be separate from the cafe because my intention is not like, ooh, come to my cafe and buy my coffee. It's really, you know, it's really about getting support for artists in this community. And that includes, you know, digital arts and development isn't art. I don't care what anyone says. So that's something I'm looking forward to here. What I want to do is start having like once a month, like open office hours where I'm just here. So like if you're a UX designer or a developer or an entrepreneur and you want to come and just talk to me about that for like an hour, that's part of the Zephyr Hills Arts Alliance, and then get other professionals to come out and do that.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, I do a lot of mentoring and a lot of teaching. And I used to do it paid, but I don't really anymore. I'd rather just give my time to people when I can, when I have it. You know, I make enough money. I'm okay. You know, I'm doing okay. I'll be all right.
That's awesome. Awesome. Well, I love that idea. I can't wait to see it happen because I'm definitely willing to participate, and we'll talk about an event that we can get together on. Sarah, I know we're pressed for time, but I want to ask you some questions that help look back on your career, get some nuggets of knowledge from you and help share with the audience. What have been some of the challenges that you've struggled with coming up as a designer?
Oh boy. You know, one of the challenges that I'm still facing and that I'm still working on is the lack of real design career ladders and role models. I work for a lot of, I've worked exclusively really for tech companies in the developer space, right? So I worked at GitLab, then I worked at CloudBees on Jenkins and Jenkins X, and now I work at Honeycomb. So I'm in a very particular space, and they're typically engineering led. Sorry about the noise. They just saw all the games and almost died. I could move to a quieter spot if you need me to.
We're good.
Okay. And it's always like the loud talker that comes in like right at the end. Never fails. Design career ladders. So what happens is these are engineering-led companies. Usually an engineer starts them. They're the CEO, CTO. Often design is not its own vertical, right? Design is sitting under product, or it's sitting under engineering. Traditionally, I've sat under engineering. Here at Honeycomb now, I'm sitting under product. So there's not a VP of design and a director of design and a design manager and then leads. And then there's this kind of hobbled together hierarchy. And so I found myself being a design manager for the past. So I was a creative director, then I was UI UX manager, then I was design manager, and now I'm design manager again. But I'm doing the job of really what a director does because I'm doing it across the product. I'm responsible for, educating across and up and out. And that's really what a director does. But because I don't manage managers, because it takes a very long time for a design team to actually get that big in any organization, I'm not recognized as a director. I'm just a design manager. Right. And titles aren't the most important thing in the world to me, but it is nice to be recognized for the work that you do. And so that's something that I think the industry as a whole is still struggling with, and that I'm seeing, as an ongoing challenge. And I have lots of conversations with people about, what does the career ladder look like for you where you're at? And what I find is that product-led organizations tend to understand the idea of the director and that cross-product role. Engineering, it's a little bit different. They're very stuck on that managing managers prerequisite. They really get hung up on that. And so then you see these design managers just kind of never go forward in their career. You know, and as a designer, I want to move forward. I want to feel challenged. I want to feel like I'm constantly being better than I was yesterday. And so I find that to be frustrating because it means that I have to go out and find that information and try to advocate for myself. And God, I'm tired. I'm just tired of advocating. I like to just do the work and have someone say, good job,
Yeah. Because You want to, yeah, exactly. You just want to be able to do the job and not have to, you know, struggle with, you know, advocating for why, you know, that these new roles should exist.
Yeah. Yeah. But I understand why. I mean, like, I'm not going to sit here and boohoo. I mean, wow, what a terrible problem to have. But, you know, it's time consuming and it's frustrating. And sometimes you wonder, like, you know, what's the point? Which I think is maybe part of why you see so many designers that really don't speak up for themselves and don't push for that change that really does need to happen in a lot of these companies.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point, it does happen sometimes too with developers as well.
I'm sure.
Even though there is a well-defined dev spec, some companies don't understand what that is. And it's just, well, you're the developer. And, okay. So now if you've been doing it a number of years, you're the senior developer, which you know, doesn't really mean anything.
That is another big thing. Yeah. You know, writing the career ladder at Honeycomb for the design team, there's nothing about how many years you've been doing anything in any of that. Because I have met many senior level designers that I didn't personally feel were senior level. And I've met many mid-level designers that absolutely are operating at that senior principal level. You know, and I think that, that's another interesting thing, you know, what makes someone a senior, what makes someone a principal, you know, and I think a lot of times it's I see that the more junior people are less afraid to make mistakes. They're less afraid to, they want to be an authority. There's that kind of like, they come out and like, this is the best and this other stuff sucks. And the more senior someone gets, the more they're like, you know, like it's all relative. There's this interesting change that happens as you get older.
It's called mortgage. All right, Sarah, I've got a question on one more because I know we're really running out of time.
Yep.
Imposter syndrome. Have you ever encountered imposter syndrome or those feelings of being a fraud in your career?
Oh.
And if so, how have you dealt with some of those feelings?
Still. I think all the time. It's been less so in the past, I'd say, year. I think the past year I've really, and I attribute some of that just to age. I'll be honest, like aging is a wonderful thing. I don't care about wrinkles. I don't care about gray hair, like whatever. The fact that I have this inner peace that has started to come over me is really nice. I think it was really raging for me in my 20s and 30s. It felt like no matter how much I knew, I didn't know enough. It wasn't the right thing. It wasn't the right time. There was always something else that came out. And I've just come to realize that, you know, there are things that I know deeply, you know, that breadth and depth kind of idea, right? There, I have a great breadth of things that I know, and there are pockets of things I know very deeply. And I own those things, and I'm curious about other things. And so when I start to feel that, and I start to think about, you know, oh, I haven't done this, or I haven't done that, or I ask myself, compared to who? Like, who are you comparing yourself to?
Right. You can't be an expert in everything.
No. And honestly, a lot of the people that I meet that have that breadth but lack of depth, it's very difficult as a manager to find where they fit in, where I can put them. But it's very easy for me to meet and to interview people and see that they have a breadth of knowledge across, you know, everything from, you know, research to front-end engineering, but they're really amazing at the discovery process and those high-fidelity designs. Great. I know where that person fits in, and I know how they're gonna level up the rest of the team. But when someone's kind of like, you know, tapioca across the board, it's really hard to figure out where they're going to help kind of shore up areas.
Yeah, perfect. And I just want to point out, that's folks who are listening, that's another person who still deals with imposter syndrome, just to prove it never goes away.
Never.
It is always there. And it, all you can do is tamper that voice down in your head. That's it. It doesn't go away. One last question.
Yeah.
Folks in our professions do not get a lot of opportunities to promote ourselves. Don't be modest. What about yourself are you most proud of? Do you love the most about yourself? What could you promote yourself right now to the listener? Any quality about yourself?
Oh, Lord, this is like horrible.
And I do this with everybody. And Yeah. The reason I do this with everybody is because people in our professions, they are so uncomfortable with saying nice things about themselves. And because they think it's kind of, you know, it's maybe braggadocious or whatever.
Yeah.
But what do you like about yourself that you would tell the rest of the world or, you know, the 100 people or so that are listening? What do you like about yourself?
I like that I can crack myself up when I'm the only person in the room. Seriously, I can take almost anything and turn it into a joke, even a terrible tragedy. And it's kind of how I find my way through things. I find humor in just about anything. Nothing in this world will crack me up more than taking my sock off and it having the shape of my own foot. Like, that for me is like the most hilarious thing in the world. It's very weird. I don't know why, but it always makes me smile. It's like, my foot is still in there. How is it still in there? But anyway, you know, I spent a lot of time in my younger years being very angry and very sad and dealing with a lot of difficult emotions, didn't have the easiest childhood. And it was a really hard for me to find that place. And I'm so proud of myself for being able to kind of get up every day and have something shitty happen and just be like, you know, just kind of laugh it off and keep moving with it. I like that about myself quite a bit.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That is awesome. That was all the questions I had for you. And I know we're at 4:59. Sarah, I hope you had some fun hanging out today.
This was awesome. I'm so glad I didn't blow you off. So perfect.
Well, I had a blast. For folks that are out there interested in hearing more from Sarah, you can follow her on Twitter at S Veselov. I'm going to spell that in the show notes. I'm not going to do that now. If you're interested in reading more about design systems and shared design language, don't forget you can grab a copy of Sarah's book, Building Design Systems, Unify User Experiences Through Shared Design Language. Or if you're in the Tampa area and love yourself some board game fun, you can check out the Your Turn Cafe on Twitter at Your Turn Cafe. And you can go to your-turn-cafe.com to check out everything about the cafe, when it's open, where it is, how to get there, what games are involved, what the specials, what the menu is, all that amazing stuff. All this, folks, and the links to everything that we've mentioned will be in the show notes below. Thanks again, Sarah, so much. Thank you for all of you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you're subscribed, I'd love to hear back from you. You can email me at hello@friendsthatcode.com. I'd love to hear some constructive criticism or tell me what kind of guests you'd like to hear on the next show. And with that, tell your friends, because next week we'll be back again with another amazing person in tech that I know that just happens to write code or design for a living. Until then, be well, everyone.